My name is Rob Sampson, and I study crime, justice, and cities at Harvard University. Previously, I taught at the University of Chicago, where back in 1995, I was lucky to help launch a long-term study of how children's lives evolve over time. Today, I'm delighted to share five key insights from my new book, Marked by Time, How Social Change Has Transformed Crime and the Life Trajectories of Young Americans. It will be published in February. In a nutshell, my book focuses on how when we are born makes us who we are, what I call the birth lottery of history. Put in its strongest form, I argue that when, not who, is what matters most. Past work on children growing up has typically followed a single birth cohort. But as we age, time marches on, which means that individual development and societal shifts in the world around us can't be separated. I take a different strategy by studying multiple birth cohorts of over 1,000 children coming of age at different times over the past three decades. The results reveal the power and mechanisms of social change, challenging much of what our common wisdom predicts about individual propensities to commit crime or what is often deemed criminal character. Insight number one, what a difference just a few years can make. Darnell Jackson, one of our study members from Chicago, was born in the mid-1990s, while Andre Lewis was born in the 1980s. Although from the same city, the same poverty level, the same family background, and the same neighborhood background, they held different tickets in the birth lottery of history. They came of age in different social worlds. By the time they were 20 years old, for example, people born in the 1980s, like Andre, were arrested at a rate more than double that of kids born in the mid-1990s, like Darnell. This difference shaped their futures, because becoming arrested is a snare that creates multiple obstacles to success in life. Take education, for instance. In our study, being arrested as a teenager, even if not incarcerated, is linked to a 25% lower likelihood of graduating from a four-year college. The book also reveals cohort differences in exposure to violence and early mortality. As crime declined from its heights in the 1990s, later cohorts encountered a less violent world in early adolescence. Importantly, they were less likely to witness gun violence, carry concealed weapons, and to later use guns when they became adults. There were even differences in the odds of being murdered by age 40 between those born in the early 1980s and the mid-1980s. The insight is that just a few years can produce dramatic shifts in being arrested and in exposure to guns and violence, even within the same generation. In this case, millennials. Insight number two, the usual suspects don't explain cohort differences. Now, you might think that the differences in arrest, violence, and gun use that I've described are due to demographic composition or early life circumstances that varied across the cohorts. That's not the case. Even after we account for commonly studied childhood and family differences, cohort gaps in life trajectories persisted. In looking at arrest and adolescence into adulthood, for example, I controlled for a range of factors, including demographic differences like race and ethnicity, individual differences such as self-control, or what is commonly known as grit, family factors such as parental education, employment, income, welfare receipt, depression, and family criminal history, to name a few, and neighborhood factors during childhood, such as unemployment, poverty, crime levels, and racial segregation. Yet after controlling for these early life differences, cohort trajectories still diverged markedly. Here's what's also surprising. Cohort differences in arrest rates are strongest for the most disadvantaged, particularly poor Black youth. For this group, arrest rates were more than two times higher in older cohorts compared to younger cohorts. Put differently, the disadvantage gap declined over time. Even among the poorest of the poor, things got much better, which is not something we might expect given the popular narrative that the world is getting worse. At this point, you may be wondering, if not individual differences, race, family, or neighborhood factors in childhood, what are the mechanisms driving the birth lottery of history? This leads to insight number three. Institutional and behavioral changes drove cohort divergence. One explanation is rapidly changing policing practices in adolescence and young adulthood. Much has been written about how the drug war led to mass incarceration. However, kids coming of age in recent cohorts were in fact exposed to declining drug arrests. For example, drug arrests in Chicago decreased from the mid-1990s to 2021 by about 90%. Second, what is widely known as broken windows policing, where public disorder is targeted by the police, also shifted dramatically over time. Disorder arrests fell by nearly 100%. That's surprising given the prominence of broken windows theory in public discourse as a way to reduce crime. But crime and disorder arrests both fell. Arrests for other crimes declined as well, including violence and property crimes. But here, policing practices only played a small role. The decline in violent and property crime arrests in Chicago was driven primarily by decreases in offending behavior, not changes in police practices. The logical question here, then, is what drove behavioral changes in crime? I argue that a constellation of factors is responsible. First, urban revitalization occurred throughout America, operating at a broad scale. Relatedly, increases in first-generation Americans through immigration helped this revitalization, in turn helping bring down rates of crime starting in the 1990s. Second, increases in community-based organizations, especially for youth, reduced dangerous and unregulated environments. Third, although the evidence is more indirect, opportunities for violence likely decreased because of increased technological surveillance in public and tracking by parents. Younger cohorts also had less unstructured time in their schedules. Finally, toxic exposure to lead, a known correlate of delinquency, plummeted, with the largest absolute improvements experienced within poor Black neighborhoods. Insight number four, social change degrades our ability to predict. Risk assessment instruments, especially those relying on prior criminal records, are widely used in the criminal justice system. The problem is that they're based on ideas of inherent criminal propensity and of consistent predictive power across time. In the book, I show that risk assessment instruments trained on the older cohort overpredict the younger cohort's arrest probability by nearly 90%. That's a huge overprediction, and it is due to changing crime and the changing relationship of risk factors with arrest. History is baked into criminal records, in other words, leading to what we call cohort bias, which I define as the systematic difference between the younger cohort's actual arrest patterns and their predicted arrest patterns based on a risk assessment tool trained on older cohort data. Importantly, cohort bias exists across all racial groups. This finding means cohort bias represents a potential source of inequality separate from racial or ethnic bias. The implications for justice are troubling. When cohort bias generates risk overpredictions, which is what I find, individuals may be denied bail, sentenced more severely, or denied parole due to inflated risk assessments. Through these mechanisms, cohort bias can trigger further criminalization, exacerbating existing racial inequalities. Also troubling is that risk assessment instruments commonly go 10 or even 15 plus years between updates, even though the world is constantly changing. Prediction is literally behind the times. And here's the twist. As social change accelerates, those outdated predictions will likely only get worse. Final insight, the character trap. We typically view character as an immutable core of personality traits guiding our actions and defining who we are. It has a distinctly moral dimension that leads us to think about, or at least talk about, individuals as simply good or bad. Consider how criminal behavior is commonly explained. We invoke supposedly stable propensities in individuals' dispositions, characters, and less frequently, environmental background. And when certain individuals or groups repeatedly commit or are arrested for crimes, they are typically deemed to possess a criminal propensity or criminal nature. This idea manifests itself in terms like chronic or predatory offenders, sometimes reaching extremes like super predators. Now, for sure, there are troubled and violent individuals, and I am not advocating that we dismiss the idea of individual responsibility or punishment. But blindness to social change in practice, especially by the criminal justice system, drives what I call the character trap, a self-reinforcing cycle that labels and punishes individuals based on assumptions about their innate criminality. This can backfire, leading those criminally labeled to conform to those same negative expectations. The character trap functions by hyper-focusing on allegedly stable individual qualities while neglecting changing social environments. Let me give you a final example of my point. Self-control is a component of character that is widely assumed to be stably associated with criminal propensity. And indeed, in my data, low self-control is related to arrest. But here's the striking finding. Individuals from the 1980s cohort with high levels of self-control had the same arrest rates at age 20 as individuals from the 1990s cohort with low levels of self-control. That is a different way of viewing the problem. Self-control does not mean the same thing across time. Our predictions for the future are once again thwarted. In sum, my book argues that cohort differences in arrest, violence, guns, mortality, and other life outcomes should cause us to rethink assumptions about stable character and propensity. They also require a distinct theoretical and policy perspective, one focused on cultivating social character instead of just individual character. Put a bit differently, we need to be thinking about moral societies more than moral individuals. This is essential for a just future, as we are all marked by time. Thank you for listening.